On April 20th, 2010, the Deepwater Horizon well, which was 41 miles off the coast of Louisiana, began gushing crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. The spill lasted 87 days and leaked approximately 210 million gallons, making it one of the largest marine oil spills in history. It brought the local tourist and fishing industries to a halt and devastated many coastal communities. Now, 6 years later, researchers are still assessing the environmental fallout on the entire Gulf region. Emmy Award-winning filmmakers Marilyn and Hal Weiner have followed some of the scientists who are part of the largest coordinated oceanographic research endeavor in history in a film called Dispatches from the Gulf. It's part of the Journey to the Planet Earth series, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Marilyn and Hal Weiner to our show, along with fisheries biologist and marine ecologist Dr. Stephen A. Morofsky. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You, Steve, you there?
Yes, thank you very
much. Okay. Just wanted to check, make sure everything's okay. So, Marilyn and Hal, how does this oil spill compare to others, such as the Gulf War oil spill, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, or the one in Greenpoint, Brooklyn? What makes it unique?
Well, this, as far as I know, is the biggest oil spill in U.S. history.
Well, in addition to that, first of all, it's not nearly as big as the Iraq spills, but it's the biggest in American history. It's also the deepest oil spill, and I think Steve can give you some more information about some of that those numbers.
Deepest because it's in the Gulf?
It was a mile down, Steve.
Yes, that's correct. This is the largest submarine blowout ever to occur in the history of the world. And it's only rivaled by a submarine blowout about two-thirds its size that occurred in 1979 off of Mexico.
As terrible as it is, hasn't it also served as a valuable opportunity to study or understand the Gulf's ecosystem?
Yeah, that's basically the essence of the documentary, and some people recently called the film a love letter to science.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that's what we wanted to be. We really wanted our audiences to understand what scientists do and how they go about doing their work. Because if you look at Pew studies and public opinion polls, scientists don't rank very high anymore. It's absolutely amazing. You know, it's become a wedge issue. And I don't have to go into which wedge is which, but these are pretty sad times when a scientist doesn't get their due.
Stephen, are you feeling you're not getting any respect these days?
Well, certainly from Hal and Marilyn. And, you know, this is a difficult issue because it's not only understanding, you know, this environmental crime, but also trying to understand how we can better regulate this industry. And, of course, when you talk about science in the public service, it's always controversial. And, you know, this is an enormous industry. It generates 500 million barrels of oil a year out of the Gulf. And so it's big money. And so anytime there's big money involved, there's lots of different opinions on the significance and the veracity of the science.
Isn't the research also into how long the ocean may need to right itself, if it can ever right itself?
That is certainly the case. We're seeing, even now, 6 years after this you know, terrible accident, that the Gulf is recovering, but at rates that are quite variable depending on the species we're looking at and the various habitats. And that is the value of looking back at a spill that occurred almost 40 years ago and perhaps tells us a little bit about the recovery rates that we can expect.
Marilyn, how many scientists did you interview in making this documentary? What are some of their fields of expertise? Because some of them may surprise us.
Right. We interviewed about 120 scientists. They're oceanographers of all different kinds. There's their soil, what do you call it?
Sediment.
Scientists, geochemists, actually. They're marine biologists. They're physical oceanographers. There's every kind of oceanographer that you can think of. So the number of disciplines was amazing. And I think that when you see this film, if you have a young kid, you're going to say, did you consider a field in oceanography? I mean, it is just so broad, and it covers so many fascinating areas.
Well, it's an exciting journey. We follow some scientists down to the bottom of the Gulf. We look at some scientists that are studying reef fish with remote operating vehicles, particularly lionfish, which is an amazing invasive, a real predator.
Where do lionfish come from? They're not not indigenous to the area.
Absolutely not. From the aquaria trade. Somebody, this is what...
They're an Asian fish.
Actually from the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody just dumped a couple into the Gulf of Mexico, and because they were natural predators, they took advantage?
That seems to be what many scientists believe, though the other possibility is ballast water could have been released in that part of the Gulf. It's hard to say, but they multiply very rapidly, and they are great predators. And we're going to go back and study that particular issue this summer with several scientists, and it's an interesting area.
Now, why would they thrive when so many of the other fish of the that live in the Gulf have suffered? Well, are their bodies different?
First of all, they're predators. They're amazing predators. So they have no enemies that I know of.
Yeah, but I'm wondering about their livers and their lungs.
Well, Steve probably can answer that.
Yeah, Steve, you've looked into the red snapper.
Well, we have, and you know, Hal is correct. There are no natural predators, and if you see a lionfish, you're amazed by both its beauty and its danger. You know, it's a poisonous fish, and it has spines pretty much all over it. There's no locally adapted predator that, you know, is really focusing on lionfish. So when you see them, for example, on an artificial reef, they're prominent. You know, they're not hiding from some presumed predator like they would be in the Indian Ocean. The other thing is, after the oil spill, they seem to multiply quicker than some of the native fish, and some of those populations may have been depressed by the oil spill itself.
Yeah, and then they're not as affected by the toxins in the water?
Well, they certainly would be, but we think that, you know, the oil spill may have kind of cleared the deck a little bit. And because these animals, they're not being preyed upon, and they reproduce almost continuously during the year, that they just sort of outcompeted the natural populations.
I mentioned earlier that it took 87 days and leaked approximately 210 million gallons before it was capped. Why did it take so long to cap the well?
Well, first of all, this is the first time that there's been a blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, 1 mile down. And it was very, very difficult to cap it, working at that depth. And you'll find in our show, Steve mentions at the end that unless we do something about the oil industry, they're going to keep moving out deeper and deeper, and it's going to be 2 miles down. And if you have a blowout at 2 miles down, Steve, what are the chances of capping that?
Well, as you point out, it was extremely difficult to basically plug this hole. The oil wells at that depth when they're drilling them, they use something called a blowout preventer, or a BOP. The blowout preventer failed in this case through triple redundancy. And what should have happened is a large pair of pliers called a ram shear should have actually crimped the pipe and shut off the valve. In this case, the three redundant systems all failed for a variety of reasons, and so the thing started to spew. There were no contingencies in place at the time to actually collect the oil or otherwise cap off the system. And the way that it was actually capped was BP and the government scientists put basically another blowout preventer over the one that was there and then turned that valve. And so that was the ultimate solution. I can tell you that, you know, since the Deepwater Horizon, the industry has basically developed a substantial amount of new hardware to basically try to get this under control for the next deep marine blowout that will occur. Now, what Hal said was really important. That is, a mile deep is was unique 5 or 10 years ago in the Gulf of Mexico. Now they're routinely nearly 3,000 meters, which is 2 miles deep. And so, you know, we're seeing an industry that's really pushing the envelope of technological development.
I'm speaking with fisheries biologist and marine ecologist Dr. Stephen A. Murawski and filmmakers Marilyn and Hal Wiener. The film called Dispatches from the Gulf is part of the Journey to the Planet Earth series, and it's available right now on the YouTube channel.
Yeah, today actually is a we're having a live streaming event prior to television release, probably hopefully in the fall. But at 2 o'clock and at 7 p.m., if you go to YouTube, Journey to Planet Earth channel, I think you'll be able to see it.
Or Dispatches from the Gulf.
Or Dispatches from the Gulf.
So, Steve, because this was so far down, we couldn't apply things that we had learned from the Exxon Valdez blowout?
Well, only to a very limited extent. And it's interesting because, you know, fighting oil spills is like fighting wars. You always seem to plan for the last one. And so a lot of planning was in place for fighting what we would call a surface spill, and that is a tanker collision. And so a lot of these plans were in place. But really, nobody had really considered significantly a scenario of fighting it a mile deep. And that resulted in a lot of really difficult decisions that were not well informed by science that was never funded and never put in place.
How soon after the oil spill did you begin your research in the Gulf?
Well, at the time of the oil spill, I was actually working for the government. I was chief scientist of the Fisheries Service, and we were mobilized along with other parts of NOAA and the Coast Guard and EPA and others. And so I started working on that almost immediately.
And were you familiar with the ecosystems of the Gulf before the spill?
Indeed. I knew a lot about it. A number of the laboratories that were under my control are in the Gulf of Mexico, and I knew quite a bit about the ecology of the region and its uniqueness.
And you did your research aboard a boat called the Weatherbird, too. In the documentary, you catch a lot of red snapper. Why that fish in particular?
Well, number one, it's quite abundant. Number two, it's quite important. It's almost an iconic species here in the Gulf of Mexico. It supports very valuable recreational fisheries and very valuable commercial fisheries as well. And so, in some sense, it's a bellwether of what's going on in the Gulf.
Now, red snapper is really important to Mexican cuisine as well. Have red snapper that far down the Gulf of Mexico also been affected?
Well, not so much by the Deepwater Horizon spill, but we have actually been studying red snapper throughout the Gulf, including Mexico. And last summer, we had two expeditions down there to compare red snapper in both the north and the southern part of the Gulf of Mexico off Campeche. And we found some really interesting contrasts in terms of what's going on down there relative to their oil industry and you know, even in some sense, residual from the blowout that happened so long ago.
Now, do fish adjust to the changes in the environment? Are we seeing different kinds of red snapper than we might have seen 30 years ago?
Well, a red snapper is a red snapper, but on the other hand, what we're very worried about is genetic damage, which, you know, if we get basically, you know, DNA damage that results in mutations, that they would be carried from generation to generation. And that's actually a subject of very intensive study right now, because obviously, you know, oil and oil byproducts are very harmful to the early developing eggs and larvae of fish.
Now, are all of the scientists you interviewed for the film largely in agreement over the effects of the spill?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Some more optimistic than others?
Yeah, I think it depends on where they were studying, what they were studying to, and what their experience was. But
it's not a question of whether they're agreeing or not agreeing. Mm-hmm. The scientists that we're dealing with are studying different species in different parts of the Gulf.
Right.
I think that they seem to be in agreement that the Gulf is very resilient. And what they're trying to determine is, number one, the state of the Gulf today and what it may be in the future. And the question about the future is a big question mark. It's one of the reasons that we went up to the Exxon, we did a sequence mm-hmm. about the Exxon Valdez. The story that we told there was of the herring fishery. Herring fishery is a very big business up in Cordova and in the area where the Exxon Valdez spilled. And
the herring pretty much disappeared.
Well, no, what happened was the herring, for some reason, survived. But
I thought they did. Well, yeah, they suffered.
They survived, and then 4 years later, the fishery disappeared. Yeah. And I think it may go to a genetic change in their bodies, and Steve probably knows more about that than
we have to go to the news now, so we'll come back to that, how it affects the next generation, how young fish either can't reproduce or become a lot smaller, and we'll talk about some of the other impacts of this terrible disaster that took place in the Gulf of Mexico with filmmakers Marilyn Hal Wiener, whose film Dispatches from the Gulf is part of the Journey to the Planet Earth series. Also, we've been speaking with fisheries biologist and marine ecologist Dr. Stephen A. Morosky. Stay with us for more. Today is the sixth anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon well explosion, which began gushing crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico for 87 days, 210 million gallons. We're continuing our conversation now with Marilyn and Hal Wiener, who have made a film called Dispatches from the Gulf, part of the Journey to the Planet Earth series, about attempts by scientists to understand the impact of it. And with us also is one of those scientists, fisheries biologist and marine ecologist Dr. Stephen A. Morosky. Now, 2 million gallons of dispersants were sprayed on the water and directly onto the escaping oil. How does that work? How does it break up the oil? It breaks it into small droplets, but that doesn't mean that the oil goes away.
No. It gives the oil, the droplets that come to the surface, an opportunity to disperse. You know, they pop.
Uh-huh. And then the sun kind of evaporates them?
Something like that. But the problem here is that a good deal of the oil still lies at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And when we followed Steve's work, that's one of the issues that he was looking at.
But I'm interested in those dispersants. What kind of chemicals are in them? In 2011, a toxicology study was done, and it reported 57 chemicals in the ingredients, including chemicals associated with cancer, skin irritation, rashes, burns, eye irritation, potential respiratory toxins or irritants, kidney-affecting toxins. Although the EPA said it was biodegradable, is that possible? Steve?
I think you have to ask the scientists.
Dispersants themselves are kind of a complex mixture. They're much like a detergent that you would use, you know, for washing your dishes. They have a chemical system called a surfactant, and then they also have a carrier, which is like a hydrocarbon. The individual ingredients themselves are not particularly toxic. Many of the bits and pieces are used in food additives and pharmaceuticals and other things. The theory behind dispersants is basically, as Hal said, they basically break apart the oil that's in large globules into small particles, thereby increasing their surface area of the total mass of oil. And so what this is all trying to encourage is that the bacteria in the ocean can actually eat the oil. It's a food source, and thereby degrading it.
What about the fish?
The fish, you know, can consume oil in three different ways. They can basically take it through their gills, and which means, you know, it, you know, particularly dissolved oil can dissolve into their bloodstream. They can take it up through contaminated prey. And also, some fish, they live in contact with the bottom. So if there's oil on the bottom, they would take it up to their skin. The encouraging thing about fish is that they, like us, can get rid of these kinds of pollutants relatively quickly. So if the pollution source is over with and gone, they can actually get rid of that pollution source very quickly. Within a matter of a few days, they basically can dissolve that, which is a good thing. The bad thing about it, of course, is when it's in there, it's toxic, and different components of oil, and oil is a conglomeration of about 40,000 different compounds, can be highly toxic and carcinogenic, and so the pathway through the animal can actually result in death or you know, severe non-lethal effects that can last for a long time.
Now, you've said that there are 25,000 miles of active pipelines and 22,000 seeps in the Gulf. That means that there are little leaks from the pipeline?
No, these are natural leaks.
Natural seeps.
Natural seeps from the bottom. You know, below the...
you mean just oil's coming up naturally? Oil, yeah, just, it would have always happened?
Yeah. It's been happening since the beginning of time. And... So this, in many ways, makes the Gulf, the animals that live in the Gulf, pretty used to oil.
Mm-hmm.
And they've learned ways of dissipating or living with the oil. And one sequence we have in the show shows a bacteria actually eating oil. And that's pretty amazing. A hell of a diet for a tiny little organism.
You have a team of scientists using an ROV and lasers to study the effect of oil and dispersants on the natural and artificial reefs.
Yes.
What did they discover? What impact it had on the reef fish community?
Well, the part of the problem, again, this was when they started studying the reefs, the natural reefs and the artificial reefs, they found that the lionfish were attracted to, was it the artificial or the natural?
Both, but the artificial ones. But
they were competing with the red snapper for food.
Well, the other thing they discovered in terms of how the oil affected, say, the red snapper along the artificial and natural reefs, were that they were as abundant today as they were before, but they're smaller. So therefore, something's going on, and I know that Steve started studying
that. Yeah, Steve, I was going to ask you about that. Why are the fish smaller now as a result of the oil spill?
Well, that's something that we see not only in red snapper, but a few of the other what we would call reef fishes. And it could be that, you know, number one, we've disrupted the food chain, which is very likely. Obviously in the ocean and everywhere else, the big things eat the little things. And if the little things are associated with the bottom and collecting oil or contaminated with oil, then that will influence their diet. It's also quite possible that we shifted the genome of these animals so that they're not as well adapted to the local environment, and so a natural growth slowdown has occurred. And so this is one of the reasons why we need to keep monitoring to see if, in fact, they return to their normal levels.
Yeah, there was another species, a team out of Miami studied mahi-mahi.
And they were breeding them for the research.
And they were breeding the mahi-mahi.
They're studying the larva of mahi-mahi?
Right, and what they're discovering is that the mahi-mahi, there are two issues. One was that their hearts have been affected in many ways by the oil spill. But the other problem is that the mahi-mahi may not be as good of predators as they used to. And may not be able to move as quickly through the environment, and that's why they may be smaller. That may be the case. I'm not sure. Steve may know about what's happening to the red snapper. They may not be as fast as they used to be.
You've been looking at their organs, the liver, their hearts, etc. Do you see any changes?
Well, in terms of the gross anatomy? No. But what we are seeing is changes in the chemical composition of many of the organs. And in the case of red snapper, what we've seen is a progressive decline in the level of contamination in the environment, particularly up around the Deepwater Horizon area, which is a good thing that, you know, they're ridding themselves of the excess oil that was in the system due to Deepwater Horizon. What we don't know is what level they will return to. As Hal said, there's a number of natural sources of oil in the environment because we're sitting over this enormous pool of oil, right? And so it drips up instead of down. And also, there are leaky pipelines and small leaks from oil wells, and oil is discharged overboard. And so that all contributes to a baseline that we don't know about. And that actually brings up one of the important lessons from this whole episode, and that is, on day T-1 of the oil spill, we had very inadequate baselines of what the levels of contamination of the soil, the fish, the water, et cetera, were. And so that's made our job very difficult.
Now, one of the things that Steve pointed out in the show is that it's safe to eat the flesh of red snapper. And I think Steve points out, don't eat the liver.
Mm-hmm. Don't eat the organs.
Don't eat the organs.
Now, one of the most stunning sequences in the film is of a mahi-mahi on a treadmill. Why would they put a mahi-mahi on a treadmill?
Well, that was a mahi that was about 3 or 4 months old, and they're trying to test how the heart is affected by the oil. And it was just fascinating. I mean, really? You want to see a mahi on a treadmill? I mean, when I heard about that, I said, I have to see this myself. But it is true. They use it to test the effects of the oil on the heart of the animal for the same reasons that Hal said, to see if it can grow up to be a predator or avoid prey, being prey, and if it swims as fast as it should.
One of the things we should point out to our listeners that it's not a real treadmill. It's right. Basically, they put the mahi-mahi in a narrow tank.
It's kind of like a wind tunnel.
And it's like a wind tunnel. And so that's constantly swimming upstream. And that's and they can increase the flow of water that they're swimming against. And that's why they can trace their heartbeats and their stamina.
What about the impact of this spill on humans? The local fishermen have been affected. Shrimpers have been affected. The tourism industry has been affected. Is that all returning?
Well, certainly tourism has returned. There's no question about that. The beaches are, for the most part, are clean.
I'm not sure I want to go swimming in that water.
Oh, the beaches are so beautiful. If you haven't been down to the Gulf beaches, especially where Steve lives in St. Petersburg along Pensacola Beach, I mean, they are just world-class beaches. And it is safe to swim in the water there.
The issue of the health issues are now being studied by scientists.
Because people eat the local fish. They eat the shrimp.
The fish are fine. The fish are fine, really. The issue is, there's two issues. One is a mental health issue, because the impact of Deepwater Horizon was very similar to the impact of the Exxon Valdez on the economies of the local fishermen. When you tell a fisherman they can't go out in the first 6 months of Deepwater Horizon or Exxon Valdez, they really had problems. Alcoholism went up. Suicide went up. Divorce went up. So this summer we're going to be filming some stories that deal with the mental health issues. And also there are some scientists out of Johns Hopkins that are looking at lung tissue to find out if people were affected by dispersants.
I think if you told Steve that he couldn't go out fishing, you would have a severe case of depression.
Indeed. I'm just waiting for the weather to break.
Dr. Mandy Joy uses the Alvin to study the bottom of the Gulf. She's a microbial geochemist, and she said that ever since Deepwater Horizon, she's had fewer holy cow moments in the Gulf of Mexico. What did she mean by that?
Well, if you go down, we have a sequence at the bottom, mile down. And if you and as she points out, if you look at what the Gulf looks at like at right now in the bottom of the Gulf, it's covered by oil, and the coral have been affected tremendously by
it. I would assume the bottom feeders would be more affected.
Yeah, they're studying that right now because it, the bottom feeders seem to have a way of coping with oil because they used to be in oil. But in a couple of weeks, we're going to be doing a sequence off Pensacola, I think, looking at the mid-level fish, the pelagic fish, and see how they've been affected by the oil. There's so much to learn still.
Well, with that in mind, because we're pretty much out of time, let's hope that we never have a spill like this again. But if we do, will we be better prepared to dealing with it than we have in the past?
That's a really good question. And to be honest, I'm not sure.
Let me add, I do think we are much better prepared. Just to reiterate, this is quite a somber day for us because we have to remember that 11 people were killed on this rig, and this is a memorial day for them. Are we better prepared in the wake of all this? I think so. I think the Coast Guard does a lot more exercises. The industry itself is under more heavy regulation by the Department of Interior. They've updated some of their equipment, and the other thing is, I think the academic community is, because of the funding for science, is mobilized. And so I think, number one, I think the likelihood of an accident in deep water is lower, although it's not completely safe. And number two, I think our response is going to be a little more full-throated.
I think you would, when you mentioned 87 days of the oil gushing out, that was about the length of this Battle of Stalingrad, which one of the scientists had pointed out to us. So just to give you a sense of how long this really lasted.
But it felt like a siege.
Well, it's almost 3 months. That's quite long. If we throw in February, it is 3 months. My great thanks to all of you for being on our show. I've been speaking with Emmy Award-winning filmmakers Marilyn and Hal Wiener. Their film, Dispatches from the Gulf, is part of the Journey to the Planet Earth series. And when can we expect to see it on television?
In the fall. In the fall on television. But right now, today, there's a sneak preview. If you go to YouTube and go to the Journey to Planet Earth channel or go to Dispatches from the Gulf, you'll be able to look at a sneak preview of it today and on YouTube.
And my great thanks to Stephen A. Morawski, who is a fisheries biologist and marine ecologist. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you for having us, Leonard.